Aid groups welcome the start of operations to send aid into Gaza from a floating pier, but say it's no substitute for deliveries by land.
We don't think that this maritime port will solve the problem. Yes, it will bring some additional aid into Gaza, but it will be nowhere near enough to solve the humanitarian challenge there, particularly as the border crossings of Rafah and Kerem Shalom remain closed.
As Russian forces advance in Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin shores up Moscow's alliance with China.
If Ukraine is defeated at the end, I think China is going to get inspired and they might take even more ambitious steps in expanding their power in the Indo-Pacific.
And a look at why autocracies are taking hold as democracies are under threat. Today is Saturday, May 18th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Trucks began delivering aid shipments for starving Palestinians Friday through a U.S.-built temporary pier off the Gaza Strip. U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby updated reporters.
Through the humanitarian maritime corridor, USAID plans to provide initial contributions of more than 170 metric tons of nutrient-rich food bars to support 11,000 of the most vulnerable children and adults, ready to use therapeutic foods to treat more than 7,200 cases of severe wasting in children, and nearly 90 metric tons of critical supplies such as plastic sheeting for shelter, jerry cans to hold clean water, and hygiene kits to support more than 33,000 people.
UN spokesperson Jens Lark with the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs welcomed the start of the operations to send aid from the floating pier, but said it's no substitute for land-based aid shipments.
Getting aid to people they need into and across Gaza cannot and should not depend on a floating dock far from where needs are most acute. Land routes are the most viable, effective, and efficient aid delivery method, which is why we need all crossing points to be opened.
John Kirby concurred with that assessment.
This is meant to be additive, this temporary pier. Additive, not an alternative. There's just no alternative, really, to getting trucks in on the ground.
He also shared that White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan will be meeting with leaders in Saudi Arabia and Israel this weekend to discuss ceasefire negotiations, hostage release, and humanitarian efforts. He also said Sullivan will stress the need to go after Hamas militants in a targeted way.
We're going to continue to talk to the Israelis about alternatives to major ground operations in Rafah. That is not what they're conducting right now. And they have assured us that they are willing to continue to have those discussions with us before they make any major decisions.
The UN says nearly 640,000 people, many of whom were already displaced into Rafah, have fled again since Israel's military offensive on the southern Gaza city began. I spoke with UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram, who was in Rafah a few weeks before the latest mass exodus.
When I was there, it was incredibly crowded. There were, over 1.2 million people displaced into a city that previously only had, 300,000 residents. And so everywhere you walked, everywhere you looked, you would see a sea of tents. The conditions in those tents are abysmal. People are living in really poor conditions. And, this is a community who were previously, living in lovely houses with televisions and kitchens. And so the shock of being displaced to a very small piece of tarpaulin, kilometers from their home without the basics that they need to survive, not only was very difficult for people in terms of just trying to make it through every day, but also really hard on their sense of mental health and their dignity. That's Rafah. On this most recent trip, my experience of the north in Khan Yunis was just utter devastation. Demolition, as far as you can see, buildings are completely destroyed, and the people that remain in those areas are really moving around on rubble, which is, of course, really unsafe because there could be unexploded ordnance under that rubble. In the north of Gaza, food remains an incredible challenge, and people are starving. I spoke with families up there receiving treatment at one of the main hospitals and met children who were severely malnourished. The doctor that I spoke to up there said that they were getting hundreds of children admitted every day. and most of them had some level of malnutrition.
When you talked about the millions of people sheltering in Rafah, I imagine there was also a high concentration of children there.
Yeah, that's right. Every second person in Rafah is a child, which, if you think about that for a second, it's very hard to imagine the purpose or the impact of an offensive in a city of children. When you walk around Rafah, you can see that it's children everywhere running around playing, trying to get food and water for their families. And at this point, many of these children have been displaced several times and exhausted, traumatized, possibly injured or sick or malnourished. We know that hundreds of thousands of children have some level of vulnerability that could impact their ability to evacuate quickly and safely.
There has been a mass exodus, hundreds of thousands of people leaving Rafah. There are Israeli operations happening and more expected in Rafah. What can you tell us about the current state of some of these vulnerable children? Were they forced to leave? Were they forced to stay?
Since evacuation orders began, we consider this forced movement because people don't really have an option to stay when they know that this level of hostility is about to descend on the city, as has been warned. So people are being forced to leave to find safety. And, you know, we know that the population of Rafah was in total about 1.4 million. So the fact that 450,000 people have moved means that a lot of people, including children, remain in Rafah. And for the children that have moved, they are now in places that are also unsafe. We know that the bombardments continue across the Gaza Strip in Deir al-Bala. It was reportedly a house that was struck with children inside. And of course, the fighting has intensified in recent days in the north of Gaza as well. So there really is nowhere safe in the Gaza Strip for the children of Rafah, for the children who are leaving Rafah, or for the children who remain in other parts of Gaza.
Do you still have colleagues that are able to work on the ground doing any sort of humanitarian support that they can in Rafah?
UNICEF has people on the ground. We are continuing to try and do our work. But of course, the security situation, the lack of aid coming in, all of these factors make it really difficult for us to continue to work. So we're doing what we can. Colleagues remain on the ground and we're not going anywhere. We're going to stay and deliver for the children of Gaza. Hospitals are no longer functioning because of a lack of staff and resources, because of the threat of the offensive, and because of a lack of fuel. One of the hospitals that I visited last month, the Indonesian Field Hospital in Rafah, that has ceased to operate. And when I was there, it was serving so many children with quite serious injuries, broken limbs, amputations, including one 16-year-old girl I met who had recently been orphaned in Rafah because of an airstrike on her home. And now that hospital is not functioning, so it raises the question of where does that orphan girl go and how does she look after herself?
UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram. The United Nations says famine is looming for hundreds of thousands of people as the raging war between Israel and Hamas threatens to derail humanitarian aid operations. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Russian President Vladimir Putin concluded his two-day trip to China Friday. He and Chinese President Xi Jinping reaffirmed their strategic relationship by signing a joint statement and vowing to cooperate against what they described as destructive and hostile pressure from Washington. Stimson Center China expert Yun Soon offered some insights in an interview with the Associated Press.
This is a very clear signal that Russia-China alignment is only going to grow closer. There's no better illustration of how special this relationship is from the Russian and the Chinese perspective.
Putin's visit to Beijing comes amid Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine as Kyiv struggles with ammunition and manpower shortages. Putin says he is open to Xi's proposed negotiations. Asia Society China expert Orville Schell says China's claim that it's neutral in the Russia-Ukraine war defies logic.
You cannot straddle a thing like an invasion of another country if you're not willing to condemn it, but worse, if you're willing to hug it out with the leader of the invader, namely Russia and Putin. It's a very, I think, poor representation of any form of any pretension towards neutrality.
Joining us now is Russia expert with the Institute for the Study of War, Nicole Wolkov. Thanks for being with us. So why was Putin's visit with Xi in Beijing so significant, and what's the motivation?
China has been increasingly providing Russia with dual-use goods. We've seen that from media reports as well as U.S. officials stating it. You know, these dual-use goods are things like microelectronics and machine tools that Russia can specifically use for its arms production and its defense industrial base. And Putin has routinely supported China's peace plan, and he may be hoping to generate more support for the Chinese peace plan, as it does have more favorable conditions for Russia than other plans, you know, proposed by other countries and Ukraine. But Putin likely seeks to deepen China's support for the war and the Russian defense industrial base.
The plan was rejected for failing to call for Russia to leave occupied parts of Ukraine. Ukraine says it will never agree to that. What else is Putin getting by the support that he's getting from Xi Jinping?
We've seen Putin attempt to cooperate and deepen relations with China as well as with North Korea and Iran. And so I think that this visit may also be part of continuing efforts to deepen relations with those three countries through different multilateral organizations, such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I definitely think that there is that materiel support with dual-use goods that Russia can use China to help it evade sanctions, for sure.
And so what about Russia's new offensive in Ukraine, particularly in the last week? It appears that the war has reached a critical stage. Ukraine's military has been depleted of weapons and manpower, waiting for missiles and artillery from the United States after months and months of delay. Where do you see the war right at this moment?
Definitely the Russian offensive operations in Kharkiv Oblast, like along the international border. Russia is trying to have the strategic objective of drawing and fixing Ukrainian forces there to then enable other Russian tactical advances in eastern Ukraine. So Russians are trying to exploit this to intensify gains in other areas, especially during this window where Ukrainian forces are waiting to receive U.S. and other Western aid and waiting for that aid to reach the front line at scale. So this fixing operation, Russians are trying to exploit during this limited time.
But you do think that Ukraine can regain and stabilize their position once the aid arrives?
If the Western military aid arrives timely and at scale.
What's timely? How soon does it really need to get there to make an impact?
Within the coming months, I think, is the best answer I can give.
What are you focused on right now as far as your analysis for what's happening with Russia in Ukraine and beyond?
We're focused currently on, well, we've always been focused on the tactical operational situation on the front line in Ukraine. And I think that we're watching the operations in northern Kharkiv Oblast amid the expectation of the upcoming Russian offensive.
How significant would it be if Russia were able to get into actually the city of Kharkiv?
Currently, Russians appear to be prioritizing creating a buffer zone over this deep penetration. And so Russians have destroyed several bridges around Vovchon. So all of these things suggest that Russia currently is not prioritizing actually a deeper advance.
So what do you think their main goal is at this point in that region?
In this region, I think the main goal is to draw and fix Ukrainian forces and resources, as well as to prioritize creating this buffer zone along the international border. I think that Russians are interested in creating a larger staging zone to conduct airstrikes against Kharkiv City and other regions in Ukraine.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Yes, thank you so much.
Nicole Wolkov, Russia expert with the Institute for the Study of War. Meanwhile, Putin's trip to China came just days before Sunday's inauguration of Taiwan President-elect Lai Ching-te. In an interview this week with the Associated Press, Taiwan's outgoing foreign minister, Joseph Wu, indicated that the Russia-China alliance highlights the threats to the self-ruled democracy which China claims as its own territory.
Putin's visit to Beijing is an example of the two big authoritarian countries, supporting each other, working together with each other, supporting each other's expansionism.
He called on democracies to align in countering Russia and China's military assertiveness in Europe, the South China Sea, and beyond.
If we are not able to support Ukraine to defeat Russia, I think China is also going to take that as an indication that democracies are not committed to the defense of another democracy. And if Ukraine is defeated at the end, I think China is going to get inspired and they might take even more ambitious steps in expanding their power in the Indo-Pacific. And it'll be disastrous for the international community.
Joining us now for a deeper dive is Andrea Kendall Taylor, Senior Fellow with the Center for New American Security's Transatlantic Security Program and the co-author of a new book, The Origins of Elected Strongmen, on why authoritarianism appears to be on the rise across the globe. Thank you so much for being with us. So is it safe to say that democracies are under increasing threat?
I think it's safe to say that over the last 20 years, we've seen a steady strengthening of authoritarianism. Freedom House, the democracy watchdog, has warned that for 20 years in a row, political and civil liberties have been declining. And a lot of it has to do with rising repression and the growing assertiveness of many of the world's autocracies, especially Russia and China, but also their increasing cooperation with other autocracies like North Korea and Iran.
It seems like a lot of these nations with dictatorial leaders, they seem to feed off of one another. They seem to support one another.
I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Certainly, Russia feels emboldened, feels confident in its war in Ukraine, sees some signs of weakening or fatigue in the West, and is pushing forward with many of his hybrid tactics against Europe. But the same thing is happening also with China, which is also willing to stand up to the United States and Europe. But I think the thing that's most interesting to me is to watch the growing cooperation among all of these regimes. Certainly, it's taking place in the military realm, but also in the information domain. So, for example, in the aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you saw Beijing parroting Kremlin talking points and helping to justify Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But the same thing also happened in the aftermath of Hamas's attack on Israel. Russia, Iran, and to a lesser extent, China were all in there in the information space, pushing narratives that were denigrating the United States and really trying to undermine and weaken the legitimacy of the United States and other democracies in the region. So they really are singing from the same sheet of music. They're rowing in the same direction. And I think that helps not only amplify their messages, but to legitimate many of them from other countries. If it was just Russia or just China, it's easier to isolate or to discredit. But when you hear it, the same messages from all of these countries, it really amplifies the impact.
Right. And you see Russian President Vladimir Putin with strong alliances with Belarus, with Hungary, with, Viktor Orban, even countries that are sort of semi-democracies. They are sort of building this alliance just as democratic nations have been doing for so many years.
Absolutely. Russia and China work together to strengthen the rule of countries, like you said, Belarus, places like Venezuela. And that's really one of the remarkable things. Again, like the more that Russia and China are working together, they're creating this alternative order. And it's really diluting the impact of a lot of the foreign policy tools that the United States and its allies have used to encourage democracy in other countries. It's really reducing the conditionality that we have historically been able to use to encourage good governance reforms and other things. But now, because they can go out and get aid and other things with no strings attached, it really is creating an environment that's more conducive for leaders all around the world who want to circumvent or undermine democracy in their own countries.
Now, with Vladimir Putin inaugurated for another 6 years, there are a lot of concerns by European countries of what comes next for him now that he feels emboldened that he he's securing his spot and he's pretty much silenced his critics. How do democracies deal with this as authoritarians gain ground even in places within Europe that are EU nations?
Well, this is the big challenge that democracies, certainly the United States and Europe, are grappling with at the moment, because you're right, now that Putin has been inaugurated for his fifth term, he does feel emboldened to pursue his aggression, not just in Ukraine, but this wider confrontation with the United States and Europe and against the kind of the West, as we would say. And what we are seeing is a significant uptick in many of the hybrid tactics that Russia uses to try to weaken democracies. So a significant rise in the number and scope of information campaigns inside Europe, but also things like arson attacks and going after railway cars and setting fire to warehouses carrying aid and weapons for Ukraine. So this really is a concerted effort and a focus for Putin. His military is degraded and weakened in Ukraine, that conventional military. And while that's the case, he's just going to double down on these non-conventional tools and tactics to try to weaken and divide the United States and Europe. So it's one of the big challenges moving forward. It is risen to the top of policymakers' priority lists. And so it's up to us to think about, how do we strengthen the resilience of our society? Are there ways that we can deter these attacks? And I think one of the key things moving forward will be to find ways to respond collectively. Because so far, part of the problem is if there's an attack on a U.S. election, it's Washington's problem. If there's an effort to meddle in France's election, it's Paris's problem. And so what I think the West will need to do is to find some way to have more of a collective response, so it really raises the cost for Russia, but also China, Iran, and North Korea, which are doing these things also, by the way, increases the costs and hopefully can help deter their willingness to take these actions that really do threaten the foundations of our democracies.
So putting this all together, beyond what you said about these autocratic leaders supporting one another, why are we seeing such a rise in autocracies or authoritarian governments, and why are democracies seemingly breaking down?
Oh, it's such a good question. I mean, so a lot of this does have to do with the assertiveness and intent of the revisionist authoritarian actors to put pressure on our societies. But there's a lot happening inside our societies as well. One of the factors that I've been paying a lot of attention to in my own research is a rise of personalism in our political system. So it used to be something that we thought was confined to the realm of autocracies, where you had these personalist leaders like Putin and Lukashenko. But increasingly, that's beginning to characterize democratic societies as well. And what we see when you have these personalist leaders, Trump is one, for example, that they are willing and able to start to break democracy down from inside. And I think that's one of the most pernicious trends that we've seen in the last 10, 15 years, is where you have democratically elected leaders who come to power through relatively free and fair elections, but then start to take steps to dismantle democracy from within. So that has been a really significant challenge that we'll have to figure out to address. Part of that has to do with polarization in our own societies. And the more polarized that our electorates become, the more willing either side is to accept these abuses if it means that they can keep the other side out. So to me, the polarization is really key, and trying to address that head on will go a long way, I think, in at least making our own democracies more resilient.
Are democracies, given what they are, the freedom that democracies allow, is that also in some way enabling autocracy?
So I don't think it's an inherent weakness. And in fact, it should be an inherent strength that we're able to stand up to protect our freedoms, that we can self-correct in times of trouble. But I think to me, the big change, what we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years, really is this polarization and these divides in society. That is something that external actors can exploit. Certainly, they're trying to feed and fuel polarization to try to increase instability in our own societies. But it is, again, it's it's not all external threats. These are problems that are happening within our own societies, and opportunistic leaders like a Trump or an Orban or an Erdogan or many of these leaders are able to capitalize. Well, A, they create, but then B, they capitalize on this kind of polarization because then they know they can get away with abuses of power because their support base will be willing to tolerate it because they're so unhappy with the other side, so opposed to the other side that they're willing to tolerate these abuses to keep the other side out. So again, that's not a fundamental feature of democracy. It's something that we've seen increase over the last 10, 15 years. And I do think policies, civil society organizations, other groups and organizations trying to address that fundamental problem can go a very long way in making our democracies more resilient.
Andrea Kendall Taylor, Senior Fellow of the Transatlantic Security Program with the Center for New American Security. She's also the co-author of the new book, The Origins of Elected Strongmen. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.